Welcome to the Baseball America Podcast. Baseball America, bringing you baseball news you can't get anywhere else for more than 35 years. Now it's time to talk baseball.
Hey, welcome everyone to the weekly Baseball America Facebook Live. I'm John Manuel, along with Ted Cahill. Now entering stage right will be J.J. Cooper in just a minute. J.J.'s pulling double duty today, so we appreciate J.J. working the technical aspects of it as well. He's going to give you expert baseball analysis as well. That's what we do every week at the Baseball America Facebook Live. I want to thank you for tuning in and remind you that they are sponsored by Baseballism. Baseballism is the official off-the-field brand of baseball, offering apparel for men, women, and kids. Shop now at baseballism.com. Enter the offer code BASHIP to receive free shipping on your order. Visit baseballism.com to shop for hats, shirts, and more today. Remember, that special code is BASHIP. And Teddy is sporting, I think the first time on a Baseball America Facebook Live, the polo shirts. So it's more than
the
just t-shirts and hats. Baseballism polo. If you have a little more formal baseballism,
backpacks, purses.
But I like the polo. I can't fit in the polo. I don't have Teddy's youthful figure. But I do have strong takes on college baseball. We're gonna talk a little 2018 Major League Baseball draft. And Teddy joined us this summer watching the college national team. I love, Teddy, that you never really take a break. You go from straight from Omaha. You come in and you're like, Omaha wasn't hot enough. I want to bake in the concrete at USA Baseball's National Training Complex and watch the collegiate national team. But I think after last year when the team was out west, it's better to – we were just glad to have them this summer. Kind of – you don't know what you got until it's gone.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a really great thing that we have USA Baseball like 15 minutes down the road. And I think we all missed the last summer that, you know, the team – spent a week in the States together. You know, it was just 1 week in California. And not only did we miss that, I think scouts missed that too, that, you know, they had to, a lot of them had to rush out and try and catch them when they could, but like they didn't have a very big window to see them either. And so to have them here in the States all summer long and to have them back in North Carolina for a few weeks was beneficial, especially for us.
I think one of the things that people liked about having the college national team back here was the way John Savage put it to me. It was the head coach of the team this summer, the head coach at UCLA. He said, usually in California, depending on the weather, it could take you 10, 12 throws to get loose. Not in the humidity of July in North Carolina. In June and July in this area, you get loose after five throws. So, because I talked to him after a recent one of my son's own practices where I threw BP for everybody, and I didn't get as sore as I thought. And he attributed that. He said, you don't get as sore when you have that much BP either. But they also had a little different team this summer, Teddy, and we're going to get into it here with JJ as well. But this college national team was not a lot like last summer's. No Alex Fado, Kyle Wright, JB Bukauskas. Last summer was a real power rotation. This summer was just different. We just did not have, and I thought the position player crop was stronger this summer for the college national team than it was for the pitchers, and that's not usually what we see with the CNT.
Yeah, I think that this year what we saw was a pitching staff that prioritized strike throwing. I thought it was very West Coast pitching staff. It wasn't necessarily West Coast heavy in terms of players, but just like the approach was very much about strike throwing over velocity and pure stuff. And that worked out really well for the national team. They went 15-5. They won all of their series. They did everything they really wanted to do. But it did mean that when we look at it, I think that some people were left a little... It was left a little wanting more in terms of pure prospect ability. And you know, some of those guys sat out the summer. They were supposed to have Brady Singer after the College World Series. He wound up not coming. He... you know, through a lot of innings, taking Florida to its first national title. And so he sat, and, you know, Shane McClanahan from South Florida, a lot of people are excited about him for next year. He's coming off of Tommy John. He sat out the summer. And so some of these bigger arm guys wound up not doing anything this summer. And that hurts the perception of the class and of Team USA. But, you know, at the end of the day, they won their series. They won 15 games. It's hard to argue with the results.
Yeah, and they had good prospects as well, JJ. And they have prospects at the top of the draft. You've already overheard this. Our offices are too close to each other. So you've overheard this many a time. But this college class, JJ, is such a study in contrast between... And the college national team had two of them at number one and number three on our list. Nick Madrigal, 5'7". If you're going to be 5'7", 161, JJ... What does that guy have to, what boxes does that guy have to check in your mind to go in the first five picks of the following year's draft?
I think, well, for one, if it wasn't for the fact that we have, and they're more physical than that, but Jose Altuve, Dustin Pedroia in the big leagues, I think the answer would be you would have to grow 2 inches and gain 25 pounds. I do think it is more possible for that guy to go top five, for Nick Madrigal to go top five, because we have, again, they're not perfect templates, but we do have templates where you say, yeah, can a 5'7 guy be a star?
Right.
Absolutely. But the other thing you have to do is you have to be able to have provide an impact in a multitude of different ways. And that's what Nick Madrigal can do. I mean, that's where he is a legit up-the-middle guy. He's a guy who, I like how you put it, which is when we've been talking in the office about it, it's like he's a shortstop. He may not be your shortstop in the big leagues because you may have someone better.
Right.
But it's not something where it's something where you do not say, oh, he has no hope of playing shortstop. And if he's a second baseman, he's a really good second baseman.
You know, another guy who kind of reminds me of who's in the major leagues right now is Ozzie Albies. He doesn't switch hit like Albies, but, you know, he had a 150 ISO in the Pac-12 this year. So he hit 380. He slugged over 500. He slugged 532. But, you know, when you hit 380, your slugging percentage is going to be pretty good. At 5'7", 160, Nick Madrigal is really never going to hit for power. And, like, we've talked a lot about power in the major leagues right now.
That's if you don't have the short guy differentiator is how much power are you going
to
hit.
I think the thing is, if he's probably everyone I talked to, I asked that question to, and the most generous I could get was 40, 45 future power, where he's going to hit maybe 8 home runs in a season. But if you're going to play up the middle, and if you're going to have special hands that allow you to make consistent contact and hard contact of the gaps, which Madrigal can do, and you're going to be a 7 runner. We got some 3-9 times on Nick Madrigal and some jailbreaks from the right side. 3.97 to first base somewhat consistently. That's pushing 70 runner. I think it's safe to say this guy's at least a plus runner with a chance to be a 70 runner, and the instincts are going to make it play. So the speed's going to play. I guess, Teddy, from the biggest question will be, is this guy going to be a big league shortstop, or is he going to be a premium defender at second base? It seems like, unless you're on a team that doesn't have a shortstop, like I look at the Twins right now with Jorge Polanco, he's a good offensive player, but defensively, shortstop is a real stretch for him. I can see Nick Madrigal being their shortstop, but I feel like most teams would say, eh, we got someone better at short. Let's take this guy who's a 50 shortstop and make him a 60 or 70 defender at second base. I feel like he's more likely a second baseman than a shortstop, but he can play short in the right situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at college shortstops, by far the majority of them are not big league shortstops. No matter how good you think they are relative to their peers,
right? Pedroia,
they just are not shortstops in the big leagues. Dansby Swanson is incredibly rare in that aspect. That if you can play shortstop, pro teams don't let you go to college. And
very true.
It's just so hard. They ask so much of shortstops that it's just incredibly difficult. And no, I don't think he's going to end up being that guy. And maybe that's okay. Maybe that's fine that he can go be an above average second baseman. But I don't think it's that. I don't think he's a shortstop. And in general, that's not a knock on him. That's just in general. If you're in college, you're probably not a shortstop.
That leads into the question that Kurt Mack has here, which is, I think, a good one. You bring up that example. Trey Turner is an example of that. Trey Turner, great college career. But Teddy, I mean, you said, like, but he has played shortstop for the Nationals. It's kind of one of those things where he plays shortstop if there's not better options out there.
Don't forget that the people did want Trey Turner out of high school. It was really only one team. It was the Pirates. But they offered him, hey, you want $500,000? You said $500,000 is your offer? We'll offer you $500,000. And Trey Turner said, he kept changing his number. The Pirates, I think, went up to 7 figures for Trey Turner. So he was another example of what Teddy's talking about. There weren't every team wasn't on him, but guys who run like that and can play up the middle usually don't get to college. He was an exception as a late bloomer. And even then, I don't think the Padres were sold on Trey Turner when they changed front offices, and that's one of the reasons
was traded. He got traded because they didn't think he was a shortstop. And, the Nationals for a while, entertained the idea, but ultimately, we're seeing that maybe he's not, and maybe he is, but these are very rare circumstances.
The better cases are actually a guy like a Caden Grenier who plays shortstop for Oregon State right now. He's got more arm strength, a more physical athlete, but the bat is behind the glove, and that's why he's compared to Zach Cozart, right-handed hitter. Very similar guys, liked him out of high school, played in the Memphis area in high school, was on the travel ball circuit and was famous. Went to Ole Miss, was on Team USA, was still a 4th-round pick because people had questions about his bat ultimately. And Now this year he was a you know all-star in the major league. So the other extreme to Nick Madrigal is Seth Beer. And I feel like the Twitter sphere, college baseball fans, because of Seth Beer's freshman season where he skipped his high school senior year, hit the ground, I won't say hit the ground running, hit the ground mashing for Clemson, and had this monster season where he was in the mix for us. He was our freshman of the year in the mix to be National Player of the Year. Offensively, he had a season as good as anybody in college baseball did in 2016. Not as good a year in 2017, but still a very effective offensive player for Clemson. Walked a ton, hit for power. He now has 3 summers, though, Teddy, with Wood, his summer after his high school junior year, and then where he reclassified, last summer for Team USA, for college national team, and now this summer, 2 extra base hits for Seth Beer for the CMT this year. This is a guy who lost basically a half second on his run times. He was a 4-5 runner last summer with the college national team. That's bottom of the scale. That's a 30 or 20 runner from the left side. We got 5 second times on him this summer. I think, Teddy, Seth Beer is at all these extremes where he brings you very little defensive value, and there are some real questions about his athleticism, but he has an undeniable hitting track record with metal. What are teams going to do with Seth Beer? I feel like he could go anywhere in the 2018 draft, including he could go through the draft and be like a token 37th round pick like J.J. Schwartz was this year. I think there's a disconnect between what scouts think of him and what college baseball fans think of him. Am I overstating that?
No, I mean, I think there definitely is, and I think there always has been. You know, from the time that he reclassified, you know, there's excitement anytime somebody reclassifies, but if you go back and look at reports from the time and look at what we wrote at the time, it was that, you know, he's not an outfielder. He's going to probably have to move to first base, and that's basically come to fruition, and that, you know, pretty much the book on him at the time remains the book now. It's just that he had this incredible freshman year.
Right.
He had a very, very strong year this year as well. And, you know, so he became very famous, but, you know, that doesn't override, you know, the larger issues that you're drafting, at best, a first baseman, basically.
At best.
You know, and you know, maybe he winds up being like Jason Giambi or something, but, you know, that's a really, really high bar that he's going to have to hit to. And, you know, even if he is hitting with Wood, it's still an exceptionally high bar. And then the fact that you have these summers where it doesn't match what he'd been doing at Clemson, you know, that just clouds it even further. But I think the fact of the matter is that if he goes out and repeats his freshman year, or even repeats his sophomore year, you know, he's looking like a first rounder still.
But that's the thing, first rounder. I do think, what was the, I'm trying to remember, I'm racking my brain for what the slogan was. It wasn't tank for beer, but it was basically...
Yeah, there was something like that. There were a lot of those slogans. You know, like, that's what
like
I mean,
thinking that he was like...
I know you answered an Ask BA question about would he be 1-1 if he were in you know, the 17
right.
draft. And like,
it's like, no.
But it's never been like that. You know, I think
he's never been that guy. He has never been that
people
guy.
People wanted him to be that guy. People meaning fans, potentially, that you know, wanted to see their team take a college hitter. Then, you know, college hitters move quickly. They want to see a bat in their lineup. A lot of draft fans, I feel like, had the same thought about J.J. Schwartz. Those guys are not 1-1 guys.
Again,
and you
there
like,
is
as
no
you laid
there
out.
Is no analog I can find. Like, when you think of the guys, the college bats who end up being kind of corner outfield types, because the reality is
most of them played other positions.
College first basemen don't go in the top 5 picks. I mean, you have to go really far back. Because most of the guys that we think of that are the college, are the successful big leaguer college, you know, first baseman came out of college. Mark Teixeira was a third baseman.
Right.
You know.
Ryan Braun was a shortstop.
Ryan Braun
third baseman.
Was a shortstop,
Alex
third
Ford
baseman.
Was a third baseman. I mean, like, these are the college corner. Like, Hunter Pence, I mean, I have to update the study, but Hunter Pence was like, and Carlos Quentin were like two of the big league regulars of the last decade who were college outfield corner players who became big league outfield corner regulars. For the most part, it's the guys are you know, college. I mean, you know who, to me, Seth Beer's closest comparison I can think of is Adam Lind. That's who he's like. If I was going to throw a comp on him, not talking to scouts, just thinking about it out loud, Adam Lind. Adam Lind can hit. He draws walks. He doesn't hit for average because he can't run. And he has had very little defensive value over the course of his career. He's been a good big leaguer, but he's Adam Lind. He's not like the way people think of Seth Beer.
And
Seth Beer has an Adam Lind career, good on Seth Beer. He'd make a lot of money. He'd be a big league regular. He'd get a pension. That'd be an awesome outcome for Seth Beer. But he's not in position to be a superstar.
And the thing that is craziest about that is, and again, there is the possibility that what we saw this summer, that he's moving better again next year. One hopes.
He's got to.
But if he doesn't, you are not talking that he's Adam Lind at age 22.
Right.
You're talking about an Adam Lind type, but what Adam Lind runs like at age 30.
That's the problem.
And
for
what
us.
Albert Pujols runs like now.
So what we're really hoping is that Seth Beer has some kind of injury to his feet that can be ameliorated, that can be repaired, that can improve. Because the gait, the way he runs, that was a real problem for scouts. And at the same time, I will not forget it, watching him with his summer teammate from last summer, J.B. Bukauskas, facing off this year when North Carolina played Clemson, and he just rained blows upon a 95-mile-an-hour J.B. Bukauskas fastball, turned on it, drilled it off the wall in right field, and as he did pull into second base ahead of the throw, winking at J.B. Bukauskas, his old roommate. So he's got hitters, actions in the batter's box. He's already got the launch angle swing. He's got power. It just hasn't played with wood either. 21 for 101 the last two summers with four extra base hits for the college national team. So I ranked him number 3 in this list. You know, Teddy, we kind of debated all over the place. And one of our other questions is about Steel Walker, Justin Cook, asking about Steel Walker. Let's move off from – I don't mean to bag on Seth, but I mean, like, he's going to be fascinating to watch going forward. Steel Walker will too, Teddy, because he's the classic guy who I think the industry always winds up light on and comes around. He can hit, and I know right now he's a left fielder, and because of Kyler Murray, he's probably going to stay a left fielder or a right fielder for Oklahoma, right? He's not going to play center fielder?
I think he probably does play center field. I mean, Kyler, how much do you have him for? And there's a lot of work there. I think Steele is that center fielder, but that doesn't mean that he's a big league center fielder.
It's too bad that Steele Walker's name isn't Swaggerty like Travis Swaggerty, because he has swag for days. The way people talk about him is that he's the most confident hitter off this college national team, but it really is that David DeJesus kind of Matt Joycey college corner bat profile where it's hit over power, but he does have a pretty good track record for hitting.
He does. I mean, he's been a very consistent player for Oklahoma. He was the best. He was named MVP of the first two series for Team USA this year. He really did it against Taiwan and against Cuba.
Yeah.
He had a really strong summer, and I think that he opened some eyes. I think that, if you like him, you can see him as this David DeJesus type, and that's difficult to decide where you draft that kind of player.
Right.
But I think that is a very valuable player once you get into pro ball.
Yeah, David DeJesus is an above average offensive player on a corner. JJ never really was a center fielder. That doesn't excite you, does it, David DeJesus?
No. I was just going to say, the thing about it is like, it's funny that David DeJesus, and then you get to the Cole Calhoun line, and which I would have said a couple years ago, I thought the David DeJesus line was above the Cole Calhoun line, and now I'll say, I think the Cole Calhoun line may be a little bit above the David DeJesus line, a little bit more pop.
Yeah, a little bit more pop than DeJesus.
But that's what you're talking about. That can be a very useful play. That's the kind of guy who does go well in the draft. Not going to be a top, the top pick or anything like that, but those are the kind of players, the same as, that the college middle infielders when we talk about Madrigal. Those are the guys that you would look back on and say, it's a very valuable pick. I mean, you're not – a lot of times you can succeed in a draft because you hit a solid double, not because you swung
right
for the fences.
I think Steele Walker's a solid double. I think he's going to hit a lot of solid doubles, and I think he is
– Yeah, I don't know that – I just saw a tweet that the Tigers think that Mikey Mata could be their future in center field. And, I don't know that he's like Mikey Mata, but I think that kind of range in the draft where Mata went – it just feels like he's a back end of the first round, and you'll wind up with a guy that in a few years somebody will be tweeting, I think we found a big league regular here.
Yeah, I think that's right. JJ?
I was going to say this John Ericola question, I like it here. It's kind of asking the question. He says, I have friends who want the Tigers to play to win and poo-poo the difference between picking fourth and picking seventh, which right now I think you could make the arguments. You could go from the wild card to picking fifth. I think it's that kind of range. But are they right or am I correct, basically in saying that that each loss here actually is valuable?
I mean, I don't – honestly, I still think the way that the draft is working out right now, guys, even in that top – once the draft, drops off, once there's a top It's like a top six or seven in some years, or a top three, like in 2010. It was seen as a three-player draft. It was Harper, Machado, Tyone in some order. And then after that, it was kind of a crapshoot. And I think that every draft has this group at the top that there's consensus about. And this year, there were six or seven guys like that. And then the consensus falls apart. And that's where you get the Diamondbacks say, well, we don't want to pay Adam Haseley over slot, so we'll go to Pavin Smith. And the consensus was Haseley and Smith were kind of similar, but the Phillies really wanted Haseley, paid him over slot. The Diamondbacks weren't going to pay him that, so the Diamondbacks took the next guy that they could get. So it just depends on the draft. If the draft is a four-player draft, then you really want to be in that top four. If the draft is a seven- or eight-player draft, then it doesn't matter between four and seven. Oh, we liked four as much as we liked seven. There wasn't that much difference. So it really just depends on the draft class. Teddy, I'm not sure that we can shake it out at this point.
I would say that no, we can't. But I would say that you want to be fourth because the difference in pool between four and seven is going to be some sort of significant number. We don't know exactly what it will be yet. I don't know off the top of my head what
enough
it was this year.
Enough to maybe get an extra player
later.
Yeah,
but we're talking about a few hundred thousand dollars, which...
Or several hundred. Yeah, several hundred thousand. That's
useful.
Especially with how it's been compressed now. To me, you saw it this year. The Braves picked fifth. Now, they made a conscious decision that they were going to spend their draft on their top two picks, Kyle Wright, Drew Waters. But because of how the draft is now, even picking fifth, you could go to essentially not much difference bonus-wise what the guys who were going 1-1 went.
This year, the difference was about $1.1 million between four and seven. And that's a significant difference to want to be four, but... Yeah.
That what I'm saying is yes, it is not as dramatic a difference as it would have been, you know, a couple of years ago. But still, the reality of it is that it's not just if it's a four-player draft or a six-player draft or whatever. It's also that $1.1 million extra dollars either means you're getting a significantly more valued, I mean, it's going to be better, but more valued player with your pick at four compared to seven, or if there is no consensus, let's say there's not. Let's say it's a three-player draft. What that means is if you're picking between all the other guys at four, then you're working a deal with someone, and then you're getting an extra guy down the road.
And that's valuable. That's how you don't have your draft all in the, you know, you don't put all the eggs in the one or two-player basket at the top of your draft. So it's hard to watch a team tank, I think, sometimes for fans, but the Tigers, they're doing that okay on their own, you know. losing games... whether they're trying to tank or not. So I'm not sure if that means they should trade Justin Verlander. That's a whole other discussion. But I don't think you'd trade Justin Verlander so you can move down three spots. You'd make a move like that to save payroll and go on a all-out rebuild. We have a lot of questions from our NC State fan friend, Justin Cook. Teddy, a lot of them have to do with players from this year's CNT. But he also asked about Andrew Kisner and Evan Mendoza off the good starts this year in their pro careers. I don't know if you've noticed, Andrew Kisner's in AA for the...
What?
Yes, he's in AA and he's hitting for the Cardinals as a catcher. And Evan Mendoza's had a really nice pro debut. I don't know if either of those guys float your boat more than the other.
If you think Kisner's a catcher, that's certainly valuable. I was skeptical of that. Mendoza's an interesting player just in terms of, like, he has the ability to be really flashy defensively and he's valuable over at third base, but, like, he also carries some questions on the hit tool, and if he could put it all together, he'd be outstanding. But, you know, Kisner might be the more consistent, everyday kind of guy if he can stay behind the plate.
Yeah, I like Andrew Kisner as a player. I'm shocked by the AA season he's had. He's hitting .330 in AA in his first full pro year. I think he's definitely one of the more under-the-radar, really good minor league seasons this year. He was a freshman All-American and then converted to catcher, and it did not come easy to him. I mean, he did it for NC State pretty much every day, but he boxed a lot of balls. He was never super quick with his transfer and throws to second base. He had arm strength, but I never saw a quick transfer. But he's only been a catcher. This is his third year as a catcher. And the fact that he's hitting in pro ball the way he's hitting, that's pretty encouraging. So Evan Mendoza was always a personal cheese ball of mine. Definitely think that he can hit. He's up in Peoria, not hitting, but he hit .370 in short season ball. I'm with you. I think the hands play. He was an outstanding defender. I hope that there's a reason why we thought NC State would be really good the last couple of years. We like their position players. They just didn't always come together at the same time. It seemed like when some of those guys were really better as sophomores and some of them were a lot better as juniors, and they didn't put good seasons together all at the same time. And that's why they wound up only getting as far as a regional 3 years in a row now where they've lost in some heartbreaking regional finals. JJ,
I got one more question here. Scott Williams asking, this one's from me, whose fault is it for how bad the Royals farm system is?
I wasn't sure if you wanted this question.
Is it Dayton Moore or JJ Piccolo? We just don't have nothing worthwhile down the minors.
I think it's JJ Cooper's
fault. It's a double negative.
Yes, but to which my answer is a simple one, which is that,
yes.
Wait, there's this thing that they wear that happened not that long ago.
Okay, but it's not just that.
It's not just that. But my point, though, is that there's a draft. The Ash Russell draft is hurting them and will hurt them for quite a while. They took Ash Russell that year. They took Nolan Watson. And they are, if they get anything out of those two at this point, it would be shocking.
That's my real question. Has the Royals front office evinced ever to you any lack of conviction in their pitcher development over the course of the dozen years they've been in charge? This group has been there since 2006. Or do they still retain full confidence in the way they develop pitching? Because I know that it's hard, but they have not had much success with it. They have had some. Mike Montgomery's had a decent big league career,
but
and Danny Duffy.
And Yordano Ventura before he...
But I mean in the draft.
Yeah.
The way, because they were 9 years in and drafted two high school right-handers in the first round. Granted, they were good in the major leagues, but you knew at the time, and they knew at the time, that the clock was ticking on that core group, and they've had so much more success drafting hitters than pitchers, but yet they still have been very aggressive drafting pitchers, and that year was a pretty epic fail 2 years out.
I will say, it's not going to be a blow you away or anything like that. They did double up 2 years in a row. The other one was they went Scott Blewett, who, he's been okay. I mean, he's not a top 100 prospect by any stretch of the imagination, but he is a useful high school arm who's kind of developing.
Jake Junis has been a big leaguer for him. Speaking of NC State, he was an NC State recruit. Same recruiting class as Trey Turner, Brett Austin, Carlos Rodon. They thought they were going to lose Rodon and get Junis. They went the other way.
And Foster Griffin, made it to Double A this year, has been a solid, again, those guys are probably more when we talk about if they succeed, it's going to be more that you hit the single or double, not you hit the home run. But
they've hit one home run in the draft pitching-wise in 12 years, right, Danny Duffy? And they do not stop swinging for the fences. There's no two-strike approach here is my point. Yeah. I mean, was A.J. Puckett their two-strike approach? The draft college guy? And they already traded him.
Yeah.
I mean, Josh Stalmont's not a two-strike approach. That's a swing for the fences.
That's a swing for the fences there.
That's my point. It's a very swing for the fences pitching approach, and it's a lot of punch chase.
Right. At the same time, my point, though, that I am making is that if you are a small market team as there is with the Royals, and you go to the World Series, and then the next year you win the World Series, and then you hit the cliff. That doesn't mean you do not reassess and say, what could we have done differently? But this cliff was going to come, no matter, they could have hit a solid double with Ash Russell, and the cliff was still going to get here. Because that's the one thing I'll say.
That's not the point.
No.
The point is, why did their system get this bad? Winning a World Series does not equal bad farm system. It doesn't have to.
Generally, I will say, though, I do think now, this is actually my point.
It is the way that things are arbitrary.
The way that it goes now is, yes, winning a World Series and having a bad farm system now, unless you're the Los Angeles Dodgers, where otherwise than that, like if you look at the Cubs now, the Cubs have a bad farm system now.
Yes.
And the reason is that when we wrote the Royals farm system in 2011, we wrote it as they were talking about they need this next wave to keep the winning going. No, what you need the next wave for is to feed to get the first wave over the hump. And that's what the Cubs did with Eloy and what they do with Glaber and all that. Now, again, that does not mean the Royals have not made, they had some draft picks that you look back at and go, that did not work out well. Obviously, Bubba Starling not turning into the $7 million man, that hurts. Things like that. But I do think also that there is a component of this, which is if you are winning at the big league level, at that point, you take whatever you have in the farm system and you say, we are throwing it We are throwing away the future to win now. And if you do that, you then have to accept it.
I understand that it's hard to win and have a good farm system in baseball right now. This is Bud Selig's creation. But again, my point is, at what point do they acknowledge the way they're doing it isn't working? And have they made any adjustments? I don't sense that they have adjusted as far as the way they evaluate pitchers in the draft and the way they draft them and the way they develop them. I don't sense that at all. And I do sense like the Cubs have. Like, our system's really heavy with players. We've got to draft a lot of pitchers. And they've thrown a lot of different means at drafting pitchers. Analytics, fastball, the way they evaluate players, international, domestic. Have you sensed that among the Royals? It doesn't seem, because it seems like they kind of are the same as it ever was.
No, I was going to say, you could argue that Puckett draft, which is, again, they've already traded away, but Puckett was a little bit more of, because that, again, they didn't have a whole lot of high draft picks last
right.
year. They didn't have high draft picks last
right.
year. And taking a Puckett, who was more of that.
Because they have had some success with college pitchers. They did draft Sean Manaea. They did draft Brandon Finnegan. And both those guys helped,
Matt Strom was a JUCO find who they
right.
turned around. You know, he had a good
but
second
high
half.
Pitchers, but they've spent a lot of money on high school pitching. And if Foster Griffin or Scott Blewett turns into a single or a double, that would be significant in this context. Mm-hmm. So I think it's understandable to have some, as a Royals fan, some like, why is it this bad? Because I don't think that the trades aren't the only reason of why they're 29th or 30th.
No.
If we did a farm system, were they 29th? When we did farm system rankings in midseason, they were the 29 or 30 of the Marlins.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The Cubs were down there, but the Cubs were down there after a very recent spate of trades with some elite prospects. That wasn't exactly what the Royals said. The Royals were going to be down there whether they had just traded. They hadn't just traded Eloy Jimenez and Gleyber Torres to get down there. So a lot of good questions on the Facebook Live as we have pretty much every week. JJ's checking out. Teddy's going to stay in the picture while I read the outro, but I want to thank everybody for tuning in again for our Facebook Live. Our Facebook Lives and our podcast are sponsored by Baseballism. Don't forget to shop now at baseballism.com and enter the offer code BASHIP to receive free shipping on your order. Visit baseballism.com to shop for hats, shirts, polo shirts, and more. For Teddy in the polo shirt, for JJ in the 6'4"3=2 shirt, I'm John Manuel. We'll see you on the next Baseball America Facebook Live. So long, everybody.
This concludes our program. Want more in-depth baseball coverage? Be a better fan. Visit BaseballAmerica.com to get more comprehensive baseball coverage.